Healy. The United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit is now open according to law. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Thank you, Ms. Geddes, and good morning. I'm Beverly Martin, and I'd like to welcome everyone to this argument. I wish we could be together in person and hope that someday soon again we can hear cases that way. On a personal note, I grew up in Macon, Georgia, and I thought that when you looked up the definition of a federal judge in the dictionary, you saw a picture of Lanier Anderson. So it's my privilege to be with Judge Anderson this morning, and Judge Anderson and I together are very grateful to Judge Tolman for helping us with our work this morning. Judge Tolman is with us all week, and he's been doing the heavy lift, so we're very grateful to you, Judge Tolman.
Thank you, Judge Martin.
This panel is going to hear one case this morning. I believe we have promised the lawyers that the first 2 minutes of their argument will be uninterrupted, so we'll try to keep track of that. Otherwise, Ms. Geddes is going to try to help us keep up with the time by announcing when you have 2 minutes remaining for your argument, and she will announce as well when your time has expired. Does that cover everything, Ms. Geddes?
Yes, Judge.
Great. All right. Then I'll call the case of the Center for Individual Rights versus Irina Shevoldina.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
May it please the court, I am Chris Haddad, and I represent the appellant, Irina Shevoldina. There is a famous quote that we're all familiar with that says, he, or in this case, she, who represents herself, has a fool for a client. And although the law regarding pro se litigants, thankfully, does not characterize them as fools, it does acknowledge, and this court has said specifically, that pro se litigants are not held to the same standard as lawyers. They're to be given more latitude and leeway. Along these same lines is the principle of law that says that any ambiguities in a contract are to be construed against the drafter of a contract, and this is particularly so when the drafter is an attorney. The final judgment in this breach of contract case in favor of CIR should be overturned. The basis for that is that summary judgment was improperly granted, and also there are public policy grounds that dictate that this particular agreement, pro bono agreement, should be voided on public policy grounds. One which prohibits the charging of a fee for pro bono representation, and also the manner of solicitation of legal services. I would like to start my argument by addressing summary judgment. The district court's granting of summary judgment against this pro se litigant, whom I'm representing now, without any prior notice or meaningful reconsideration was highly prejudicial to Ms. Shevoldina. In fact, her opponent, CIR, did not seek summary judgment on the breach of contract claim, instead taking the position that what it calls the assignment clause or the settlement clause of the contract created genuine issues of material fact about whether Ms. Shevoldina was required to request a reasonable amount for CIR's costs and expenses, disbursements, and attorney's fees pursuant to the pro bono agreement. The district court, however, granted summary judgment in favor of CIR, finding that the agreement between CIR and Ms. Shevoldina, was a valid contract. And the district court found no ambiguity in interpreting the agreement, and so concluding, the district court determined that Shevoldina or her counsel instructed CIR to withdraw its motion for approximately $114,000 in attorney's fees based on the terms of a favorable resolution that Ms. Cevaldina reached in her state court litigation. Interestingly, docket entry 25 is cited in the order granting summary judgment, specifically page 10, to support that the $114,000 was something that Ms. Cevaldina had instructed CIR to withdraw its motion for. In looking at the docket, however, docket entry 25 does not seem to reflect that. So I would ask this court to, and because this is a summary judgment, the standard for review is de novo, I would respectfully request that this court to review that docket entry, and that supports the position that the district court's ruling was erroneous in that it wasn't based on an accurate recitation of what's in the record. Now, in terms of the rules of civil procedure, I will acknowledge on behalf of my client that the district court may grant summary judgment on grounds that are not raised by a party, but only after giving notice and a reasonable time to respond, and that's Rule 56. Here, instead of notifying Ms. Cevaldina that the court was considering granting summary judgment on the grounds that she conceded that the $10,000 payment was sensible or a reasonable fee under the contract, the district court simply acted and granted summary judgment. And so, had Ms. Cevaldina been afforded a reasonable opportunity to present evidence to the contrary per Rule 56, she would have been able to present evidence that showed that ongoing negotiations between a multitude of parties, including Ms. Cevaldina's attorneys, Mr. Katz's attorneys, who was involved in other state court litigation with Ms. Cevaldina, CIR itself, and Mr. Rossman, was ongoing. So there was, you know, a multitude of parties and negotiations that were going on, and there is evidence in the record to support the fact that Mr. Rossman, on behalf of CIR, had authorized these negotiations to go on. Docket entry 160 is a email where Mr. Rossman is emailing the attorney, Mr. Schachter, regarding the negotiations. And
this is Judge Anderson talking. Is that the email dated December 14, 2015?
It is correct, Your Honor, at 5:03 p.m.
In which he, in effect, says to Schachter and Cevaldina that Adam, he's talking to Schachter, I'll leave the negotiations to you.
That is correct, Your Honor.
So your position is that that creates a genuine issue of fact as to whether or not CIR authorized Schachter to negotiate the settlement for CIR as well as for Cevaldina.
That's correct, Your Honor.
That is correct. You suggest that we should vacate the district court summary judgment on breach of contract, both because of the Rule 56 notice violation, sua sponte issue, and also genuine issues of fact.
That is correct, Your Honor. That is exactly our position. And there was, you know, the district court judge's ruling, which appears to, again, have been premised on this idea that Ms. Cevaldina somehow had represented that $10,000 was a sensible or a reasonable amount for CIR to be paid. Again, as I point out that is not reflected in the record as so reflected in the order granting summary judgment, but also in terms of the prejudice to Ms. Cevaldina that goes beyond the mere notice and an opportunity to present evidence, which are obviously significant in and of themselves, particularly when dealing with a pro se litigant. But also, Ms. Cevaldina would have had an opportunity, had she been afforded that, to put that alleged statement, in context in terms of and this would have contradicted the district court's finding that the statement was somehow a concession that this pro bono agreement contemplated the payment of attorney's fees. Also, the agreement called for CIR to fund the case through outside funding, although it was labeled a pro bono agreement. Again, in the terms of prejudice,
this is Judge Anderson speaking.
Yes,
again.
Sir.
You're getting into your argument that this contract in its entirety, the retainer agreement, is void as against public policy. Because it represented itself as a pro bono agreement, but really contemplated fees. That seems to me to be, frankly, with respect, a near frivolous argument, in that pro bono work often, in fact, routinely contemplates court awarded fees for the pro bono attorney upon prevailing or upon settlement and recovery of amounts from the opposing party, reasonable fees out of that recovery. Is that not a common occurrence?
I don't know how common or
uncommon. Your time has expired.
You can please go ahead and answer Judge Anderson's question, if you would.
Yes, Your Honor. I cannot speak to how common or uncommon it is. I raised that issue in terms of the question of the rules of professional conduct, rules regulating the bar for Florida, specifically define a pro bono agreement as one that does not contemplate a fee. And so that was the basis for that position, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Rossman?
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Michael Rossman. I represent the Appellee Center for Individual Rights. This case has been extensively briefed. I'd like to highlight four or five points for the court. I'd like to point out the absence of prejudice from any procedural error. I'd like to point out that there has been waiver of Ms. Cevaldina's various illegality defenses. And I'd like to discuss this issues of material fact that Mr. Haddad raised in his argument.
Judge Martin, this is Judge Tallman. Our phone lines went down after 3 minutes and 14 seconds of the argument, and I just
I didn't realize that. I know you were. I noticed you were quiet, Judge Tallman.
I'm usually quiet.
that means you missed most of Mr. Haddad's argument.
That would be correct.
Okay.
You got his first 3 minutes and 14 seconds.
Mr. Rosman, the best way I know how to handle this is to allow you to sit down and start over in just a minute. Could you just tell me, you didn't hear any of Mr. Rossman's argument either, I guess.
No, I didn't hear anything from Mr.
Okay. So if we could have Mr. Haddad come back to the podium, and I don't know how to do the timing on this, but I'd like to give Judge Tallman a chance to question Mr. Haddad. So we'll just see how that goes. And Judge Tallman, maybe once you are satisfied that you understand the argument you'll, on behalf of the appellant, you'll let me know, all right?
I certainly will. And Mr. Haddad, I lost you at the point where you were explaining that Shevoldina would have been able to present evidence in opposition to summary judgment, but I don't know what evidence you thereafter outlined.
Thank you. Thank you, Judge Tallman. May it please the court if I may proceed. I will try to pick up from that exact point. So in addressing the argument that the district court's sua sponte ruling for summary judgment was prejudicial to Ms. Shevoldina, I've outlined how I believe the prejudice was significant in this case and warrants the summary judgment being overturned. So instead of, I pointed out initially that in the district court judge's determination for summary judgment, the court said that the Ms. Shevoldina or her counsel instructed CIR to withdraw its motion for approximately $114,000 in attorney's fees based on the terms of a favorable resolution that Ms. Shevoldina had reached in her state court litigation. And there's a reference to docket entry 25, and a review of the record indicates that docket entry 25 does not have such a document or any sort of statement by Ms. Shevoldina. So I would respectfully request that the court look at that issue. And then it also, I was pointing out that by Ms. Shevoldina, instead of notifying her granting summary judgment on the basis that she, essentially the district court had determined that she had conceded that $10,000 was a sensible or reasonable fee under the contract and therefore granted summary judgment. Had she been afforded a reasonable opportunity to present evidence to the contrary, she would have been able to present evidence showing the ongoing negotiations between a multitude of parties, including Ms. Shevoldina's attorneys, Mr. Katz's attorneys from the other state court case, CIR itself, and Mr. Rossman. And Judge Anderson had noted that I had referenced an email, which is found in docket entry 160, where Mr. Rossman sends an email to Adam Schachter, the attorney involved, on December 14, 2015, essentially saying, I've spoken to my boss. If CIR can get $75,000, that would satisfy it. So he's authorizing the negotiations to go on. And also, had she been afforded the opportunity to present evidence in opposition to summary judgment, that would have given her the opportunity to place the alleged statement regarding $10,000 as a sensible or reasonable amount in proper context. This would have contradicted the district court's finding that the statement was somehow a concession, that the agreement contemplated the payment of the fees. And
well, as I understood the record, in the state court litigation, Katz was going to have to pay her more than $100,000 in fees. Is that correct?
That is, well, I believe so. Yes, Your Honor, there was an award that was in excess of that amount. However, she did not receive that much. But
I understand that. It's just that what we had here were essentially dueling attorney's fees that were in play. Katz was potentially liable to pay her attorney's fees in the 11th Circuit litigation, and she was potentially liable to pay Katz attorney's fees in the Miami litigation, and that was all part of the negotiations that resulted in a global settlement. Have I got that right?
That is accurate, yes, sir, Your Honor, and that's why I made the argument in terms of the context of the statement and the intent behind any statements that she would have made regarding, you know, the settlement and the authorization to settle. So those were material questions of fact regarding the reasonableness of the money, the $10,000 or the settlement amount. And for those reasons, summary judgment was, in you know, from our perspective, improperly granted and prejudicial. And also, I failed to note earlier, I'll just briefly state, the motion for reconsideration that was filed, which I believe opposing counsel has indicated, gave Ms. Cevaldina the opportunity to make her case anyway. The standard for review of a motion for reconsideration is different than summary judgment, and the order that was entered on the motion for reconsideration did not go to the substance of any of the issues in summary judgment, and simply just made the finding that what the circumstances didn't warrant the extreme remedy of reconsideration.
Okay, I think I have your contract argument in mind. Did you address the Florida DPPA counterclaim?
I did not, Your Honor. I essentially will rely on the written brief for that.
Okay, right, and then how about the? That's fine. I got it.
The public policy argument I started to address, and then I ran out of time. And depending on counsel's Mr. Rossman's argument, I may have an opportunity to respond to that.
Very well.
We've reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal, and we'll give that to you.
Thank you, Judge Martin.
All right, thank you, Mr. Rossman.
May it please the court. My name is Michael Rossman. I represent the Appellee Center for Individual Rights. This case has been extensively briefed. I'd like to highlight 3 or 4 points and then respond to a few of Mr. Haddad's arguments. First, I'd like to discuss whether there's been prejudice. Second, whether there's waiver of any of these various illegality defenses. And third, whether there were any issues of material fact that were raised in the lower court. Now, as to prejudice, under Rule 61, it is appellant's burden to show that any procedural error was prejudicial. Now, Mr. Haddad says in his argument that it was highly prejudicial for the court to grant summary judgment without notice. But if you look at the most recent brief that he filed, their reply brief, and do a word search for the word prejudice, it doesn't appear. And that's because he makes no argument, none whatsoever, in his brief as to how any procedural error was prejudicial. And I submit, under the procedures of this court, he has waived the argument that it was prejudicial. As to illegality, Rule 8C of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure requires that all affirmative defenses be pled in the answer. Illegality is an affirmative defense. Ms. Cevaldina did not plead it in her answer, and thus she waived it. And again, if you review Mr. Haddad's most recent brief, 8C doesn't appear anywhere in it, and there is no mention of the fact that Ms. Cevaldina simply did not assert it in her answer. Now, as to whether or not there were issues of disputed fact, Cevaldina makes essentially two arguments. First, that we conceded it in opposing her motion for summary judgment, and second, that the district judge didn't supply enough detail on the issue of damages. Now, as to the concession, we didn't concede anything in our opposition. If you review the pages that Mr. Dodd refers to, they're mostly arguing that Cevaldina's so-called material facts were not material at all.
And counsel, this is Judge Anderson speaking, and it seems to me, this is just my thinking, seems to me that there are considerable issues of genuine issues of material fact that would preclude summary judgment, and I list a few. First, the 12/15, December 15, 2015 telephone conversation in which Rossman claims that he told both Shackman and Shevoldina that $75,000 would be satisfactory and that $10,000, which he already knew about was being proposed, was unreasonable and would be considered a breach. The problem with that is that Shevoldina's affidavit expressly disputes precisely that, seemed like to me creating an issue of fact. Next, your own CIR's own answer to interrogatory, I forget the number, says that it never advised Shevoldina not to enter a settlement or otherwise that the settlement amount was unreasonable. And that seems to me to bolster Shevoldina's affidavit that she was not told that it was unreasonable or, and would consider a breach, and not Rossman's affidavit to the contrary. Another interrogatory that CIR answered was that they couldn't remember the specifics of the telephone calls, and they didn't mention this. They did not mention that it would be a breach of contract. And then there was the December 17 email, which came, of course, after the December 15 telephone call, that gave wire transfer information to Schachter so that CIR could receive the $10,000. And that is the one that did not mention it being a breach of contract. That I misspoke when I talked about the previous interrogatory not mentioning the breach of contract. But the crucial thing is that on December 17, that email does not mention a breach of contract. And then finally, on December 14, which is the date before that crucial telephone call, Rossman says that they'll be satisfied with $75,000. But then he says, and I'm quoting, he says to Schachter, "I'll leave the negotiating part of it to you." Seems to me that creates a genuine issue of fact that that Rossman actually authorized Schachter to do the negotiating for him. Of course, we're not interested in the credibility of the parties, but we are. All we're interested in is that there's a genuine issue of fact.
Thank you, Judge Anderson. Let me respond to the last one first, if I may. The December 14th email was the subject of a motion in limine. The court excluded it. Ms. Shevoldina has not appealed that order excluding the December 14th email. It is inadmissible evidence in this case.
What about the rest of what I said?
Yeah, okay. $10,000... the argument that we did not say specifically that the 10,000 there is an issue of fact, it's just not material because you don't have to tell the other party that they're breaching a contract. A breach is a breach. If they breach the contract, that's a breach. There's no obligation to give them notice. That we did not advise Ms. Shevoldina not to take the settlement. Ms. Shevoldina was being represented by lawyers in state court. The whole negotiation was a negotiation of a settlement in another lawsuit. We had no obligation to advise her about whether to enter into that agreement or not. It wasn't our case. The specifics of the telephone calls are specific words, Your Honor.
Counsel, Judge Anderson talking.
Your
retainer agreement seems to me to suggest that you will advise Cheveldina with respect to the amount of attorney's fees for your case in the 11th Circuit.
You'll have to give me the language because I don't think it says that at all.
I'm quoting, CIR may withdraw from the representation or may require, and the preface to that is if client refuses a settlement offer that CIR considers reasonable.
Well, that's the important part of it, isn't it?
Yes. In other words, you've got to express the reasonableness, well, no.
If it's a reasonable settlement, then that obligation kicks in. That's not what happened here. If she refuses a reasonable settlement, she wasn't refusing a settlement. She was, on the advice of a different attorney, going into a settlement. That provision that you're just describing kicks in if there's a settlement offer on the table and she says, no, I don't want to settle. This has nothing to do with our set of facts. And then the last thing...
Mr. Rossman, this is Judge Tallman. Are you saying that when you withdrew your petition in the 11th Circuit for $115,000 in attorney's fees plus costs, that you did not know you were only going to receive $10,000 out of the settlement of the Miami action?
No, we did know that, Your Honor, but we were instructed to do so by Ms. Cheveldina. That's the whole...
And at the time you did that, you had in your mind that that was an action in breach of contract and you were going to turn around and sue her for that later?
Yes.
Okay.
But you did not say that in your December 17 email.
December 17th email was after the fact, Your Honor. I don't have it in front of me, but under the agreement, take a look at the agreement that Ms. Cheveldina's state court attorneys entered into. Under the agreement, this is what we were obligated to do, and we were instructed that we were going to follow that agreement. So we provided the information that that agreement required us to provide. If I may return to my argument, Your Honor. So the question of damages, that argument was also waived by Ms. Cheveldina by not raising it in the district court on her motion to reconsider. And again, in Mr. Haddad's most recent brief, she does not dispute this at all. You can look at part three of her argument. The first sentence of part three points out that we do say that she waived this argument, and then says nothing at all thereafter about it, never any explanation of why she did not waive it. There was a reference that Mr. Haddad made at the outset of his argument about Ms. Cheveldina being a pro se litigant, and that is true. She was a pro se litigant, but this court has consistently held that pro se litigants have to follow the rules, and I will cite Moon versus Newsom, 863 F. 2nd, 835, where a case was dismissed because a pro se litigant failed to appear for a deposition and then failed to pay the sanctions that was imposed as a consequence. Ms. Cheveldina had an opportunity to put in any evidence she wanted in her motion to reconsider. That's where she had an opportunity to put in any evidence she wanted, any arguments she wanted. She did make arguments. It's just different than the arguments she's making now. And by failing to make them at the time that she made her motion to reconsider, she waived any other arguments. I'd be happy to answer any of the court's questions, either about the cross-appeal, or the DPPA argument. But other than that, I have no additional things to say.
Counsel, did the district court err when it failed to credit the $10,000 that you had received when it entered judgment in the full amount of $115,000, which with interest is now at $133,000?
Well, I don't know exactly what the district court did, to be perfectly blunt. We had asked for more like $119,000 in damages because there was post-motion fees, and he reduced that to $115,000, roughly. And if he did that by, he may have neglected the $10,000, or he concluded that we were only entitled to $10,000 for the work that we did. That's part of 149.2, sort of towards the back of 149.2 on pages 85 to 89.
This is Judge Anderson. I'd like to ask one question about your cross appeal. You, in your operative brief, the last one, simply refer to your previous brief, which is a violation of our rules, and under we have discretion to simply disregard your argument in that regard, which I might be inclined to do, except the claim of fabrication of evidence gives me a little pause. Would you give me a little detail about that?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, there was two sets of briefs here, and we were told by the clerk's office that we didn't have to repeat the same arguments that we made in our first set of briefs in the second set of briefs. So I'm not sure what rule you're referring to when you said that it's a violation of your rules. I know I didn't refer to any brief in the lower court. I referred to another brief that we had filed in this court. And if you review the first brief that we filed...
We'll look at that. I was not familiar that the clerk gave you such directions, but focus on the claim of fabrication for me, if you would.
Well, as you know, Your Honor, we made a motion in the court claiming that Ms. Shevaldina's opposition to our motion for summary judgment on the Driver's Privacy Protection Act claim was fabricated. The lower court, and we put in an expert's evidence to support that proposition. The lower court, well, there was a report and recommendation that the motion for an order to show cause be denied because it was moot, and eventually the district court dismissed all pending motions as moot. So that's the background of it. If you review, it's discussed at great length in the first principal brief that we submitted in this case. I'm not sure what other pieces, but that's sort of the gist of it.
All right, I'll ask the other side about that.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'm afraid I didn't.
I think Judge Anderson was indicating that he had gotten information from you that he wanted, and he'll take it up with Mr. Haddad. Did I get that right, Judge Anderson?
Correct. Correct.
All right. All right. So, Mr. Haddad, you have reserved five minutes for rebuttal, and we'll hear from you now.
Thank you, Your Honor. Well, I will begin by addressing the issue of the prejudice again and whether that was adequately raised previously. In fact, in looking at the motion for reconsideration that was filed by Ms. Shevaldina pro se at the time, she did raise the question of the $114,000 and the fact that CIR had authorized the negotiations regarding that amount, and that outside counsel was being used in that regard to facilitate the negotiations. And all of those questions and all of those issues pertain to the district court's granting summary judgment sua sponte, and also the question of the reasonableness of the fees, the $10,000. And as has already been pointed out, Mr. Rossman authorized those negotiations and did accept the $10,000as from Mr. Katz when it was sent to him. In terms of other issues relating to summary judgment, I don't know if the court has any other questions. If not, I would move on to the public policy argument. In terms of the public policy argument, one of the issues deals with the manner in which Ms. Cevaldina retained CIR. And the evidence shows that Ms. Cevaldina received an email from CIR.
Counsel, this is Judge Anderson talking, and you're about to get into your solicitation argument.
Correct.
Does not the relevant Florida statute expressly exclude legal aid organizations?
Well, there is, I believe it does, yes, Your Honor. However, it would be our position that this organization is not operating as a legal aid organization. CIR is a law firm that's domiciled in the District of Columbia, and they do not, as I said, operate strictly as a legal aid organization, such as we have in Florida and throughout the country, which are attorneys that work, on a salaried basis and do pro bono cases throughout the state. This solicitation, I mean, there are cases that talk about contracts being voided as a result of solicitation. I've cited a few of them in my brief, Spencer Payne versus Gerson, and Thomas versus Ratner are two examples where attorneys reached out to litigants regarding prospective representation, and the act of doing so was deemed to be violative of the statute prohibiting such, and therefore would serve to void the contract ab initio.
Okay. Counsel, Judge Tallman, I thought the state of the record was that Professor Eugene Volokh at UCLA had been contacted by Cevaldina, who was seeking counsel, and that Cevaldina referred her inquiry to CIR, who then reached out to her to ask if she would be interested in talking with them. What's improper about that?
Well, I think what happened, Your Honor, was she had reached out, and then there was the initial our issue, Your Honor, is that CIR was the one that initiated the contact with Ms. Cevaldina. Now, the fact that the professor from UCLA may have been a conduit or somehow involved in the negotiation still doesn't detract from the basic fact that CIR reached out to her first.
But if she approached Volokh asking for representation and the professor, for whatever reason, said, well, I can't do it, but let me refer you to somebody who can, what's improper about that? I'm having a hard time understanding why that's an illegal solicitation. Maybe I don't understand Florida rules of professional conduct.
Well, there's nothing improper about that, Your Honor. However, it's our position that the contact should have between CIR and the Ms. Cevaldina should have been should not have been initiated by CIR.
Well, but it wasn't. If the state of the record is that she made the first overture, and he simply referred her to another lawyer for whatever reason, this is not like Mr. Rossman was making a cold call on her client because she had an interesting case that CIR was interested in.
No, Your Honor, it is not. And I concede that that was not a cold call sort of, you know,
solicitation. Counsel, your argument has expired.
Judge Tolman, as Mr. Haddad has, you know, satisfied your question, we will end the argument
yeah.
now. Is that all right?